I decided we will do is I'm going to mention only a couple of things out of Variations in Fundamental Theology, and then let you ask any questions that you may have on it. But I think what the thing that appeals to me the most is if in the notes that I prepared, if you would go to page 4 and number 8, just the one comment. At the beginning of number 8, and then I'm going to skip down to number 10. The successor to Neoscholasticism in the wake of the Council. So he's talking about the older fundamental theology found in the Neoscholastic framework, and that's obviously no longer acceptable, and so on. The successor to it was the turn to the subject. So he's still back, this is 25, 30 years ago, because there are a lot of people who would want to say, well, the turn to the subject, that helped us for a little while, but no. I'm not in that camp. I think that Lonergan's turn to the subject is what will see us into a new age in theology. But anyway, what I want to do is to go down to number 10 here, because in number 9, numbers 8 and number 9, he goes through the cognitional part, so that's just, we're all familiar with that, with experience, understanding, judgment, and all of that. Number 10, the priority of the cognitional yields to the moral. That's experience, understanding, judgment yields to decision, and so the existential becomes. But this is new. This is not in method in theology. The moral yields to the interpersonal. It's a new emphasis. It's a new statement. To make a sound moral judgment, one has to know the relevant facts, possibilities, probabilities. That's the cognitional yielding to the moral. So the cognitional underlies the moral but yields to it. But with those conditions fulfilled, the moral judgment proceeds on its own criteria and towards its own end. But, again, moral judgments and commitments underpin personal relations. But with the underpinning presupposed or even merely hoped for, interpersonal commitment takes its own initiative and runs its own course. So here's a whole new set of dynamics that he hasn't really discussed as a distinct set of dynamics in insight or in method and theology that he's now opening up, the interdynamics of interpersonal commitment. The relations of the levels are described in the familiar terms of successive sublations, so experience, understanding, and then judgment sublates experience and understanding, decision sublates experience and understanding and judgment. We got a new sublation. Beyond the subject is experiencing, as intelligent, as reasonable in his or her judgments, and as free and responsible in his or her decisions, there is the subject in love. So there is that. The last, right prior to that, the last sublation. So finally, interpersonal commitments stand to cognitional and moral operations. So understanding sublates experience, judgment sublates experience and understanding, moral operations sublate the whole cognitional structure, but interpersonal commitments sublate everything. There's some kind of higher synthesis of the person in love in interpersonal commitment. A whole new set of dynamics that he's just putting out on the table that he really hasn't spoken about in any way to spell out what's involved. Okay, so it comes back to the subject in love, but here he's putting it into this context not only of the love of God, which we're familiar with, but also interpersonal commitment of the human realm. So I want to point that little part out. And I think I'm going to have to leave it at that, because there are other things in here that are very interesting. It's very interesting that he turns to Panikkar, and in another couple of papers we'll see Panikkar and Robley Edward Whitson are the two people that he's turning to for guidance in terms of interreligious dialogue. But this is the earliest, I think, reference to Panikkar's pluri-theological dialogue, breaking the bounds of some single universe of discourse, manifesting the work of the one Spirit of God in diverse cultures and traditions. And again, in the Prolegomena to the Study of the Emerging Religious Consciousness of Our Time, he will say that we're just at the beginning of that, so much so that we don't even have the language for it yet. Okay, I'm going to stop there on this one and see if you have any questions on it.
Yeah. Well, this looks very similar to the concept of grace in Deutrino, in the Trinity.
Oh, on the interpersonal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, when did he write Deutrino?
The chapter 6 was written, first of all, published in 1957 as a part of his earlier version of that text, Concepcion of Divinarum Personarum. So 57. So he's got, it's there. But to talk of it in these terms as a yet a further level or a further sublation, that's what's new, I think. He has the interpersonal notion of grace. It's already there in chapter 6 of the Deutrino, you're right. That the state of grace is an intersubjective situation for Lonergan. It's not an individual. It's not something individual. It's an intersubjective situation. The three divine subjects and the community of human subjects. So that's the state of grace. There's a habit of grace in each of us, but the state of grace is the intersubjective situation of the three divine persons and the three divine subjects and the human subjects who are in love with the three divine subjects and in love with each other. That's the state of grace. So there's the germs there for a whole social theology of grace, and I've tried to say that, you know, like as 30 years ago we talked about sinful social structures, so now can we begin to spell out what would be grace-filled social structures? What would that be? You know, so again, a new theology. But yeah, so that's there, and it was a radical statement for somebody. There's so much in that last chapter that has not yet been picked up, the last chapter of De Deutrino, that has not yet been picked up on by anybody. And this is one of them, the intersubjective character of grace itself. The other is the four-point hypothesis. That's there. It's just buried in this dusty Latin tome, pages 234 and 235, and we're starting to pick up on it now as an integrating part of an integrating unified field structure for systematic theology.
Why didn't if it was in 1957 that he wrote the Deutrino, why didn't he mention it in Method? In Method, it looks like the dynamic state of being love is a personal...
Yeah. Well, see, it is, but if you look at where he's talking, he says it's not so personal as to be private and solitary, and then he says it is given to many, and they can discover each other, and they can form a community, and so on and so forth, and so it's personal, and then it's communal, and then it's historical, but the emphasis is definitely still on the personal. There, you're right. And to talk of levels of consciousness in this way, where you've got the moral yielding to the interpersonal, which has its own set of dynamics, is something new in his writing. To put it this way, so he's saying as understanding stands to experience. As judgment stands to understanding and experience together, as decision stands to all three of those, sublating them, so interpersonal commitments stand to cognitional and moral operations, carrying them forward in their own dynamics. So again, you've got the communitarian emphasis.
Where would you find this? Him speaking about the state of grace as...
In the sixth chapter of De Deutrino, Pars Systematica, and we've got that in translation now. It's the final thesis, or the final assertion. If you want the translation, I'll send it to you. It's an email attachment or whatever. Because the manuscript is at the press now. It's going to be the next volume to be published. But what I'm worried about is that volume itself is going to be so big that people still won't find this stuff because they won't
they won't read to the end of the book where it is, you know, because we're going to put it out with Latin and English facing pages, so it's going to be a 1,000-page book. Or it's going to be huge.
Yeah, we can put in a note then. We can put in a note. At least read
chapter 6.
I'm going to put it in the editor's preface. You can skip everything else here, but read chapter 6.
All right. Were there any other questions that you wanted to raise on the fundamental theology, Jess?
In section number 8 of your notes, you're taking up the transition from neo-scholasticism into this turn to the subject, motivated here in his treatment by modern science.
Right.
Number 9 deals with what the turn to the subject incorporates from the standpoint of philosophical currents, but in number 8 we're dealing with modern science.
Right.
It calls for the abandonment of objects of infallible intuition, self-evident truths, necessary conclusions. Now, how far does this spill over into our realms of knowing? I'm thinking, for example, of revealed truths. We see a move here from necessary conclusions, self-evident truths, into the more contingent. That may be correct in many domains of knowing, but how about within revelation?
Okay, self-evident truths. It's a turn from revelation is God's entrance into the world mediated by meaning. This is a notion of revelation that Lonergan articulated prior to these lectures and even prior to Method and Theology, when he started working with the varieties of meaning under the influence of hermeneutical philosophy and so on, which is a post-insight development for him. Okay, insight, in insight, he's coming to grips with modern science. But post-insight, when he moved to the Gregorian and had all these students from Europe, he had to come to grips with existentialism, phenomenology, and hermeneutics. And so the period from 1957, starting with the existentialism lectures in Boston down to 1965, he's dealing with the varieties of meaning. The world mediated by meaning is an expression, post-insight expression. The real world is the world mediated by meaning and then constituted by meaning. And so on. All right, now, in that context, revelation is God's entrance into the world mediated by meaning. God brings God's meaning into that. Now, how does God do that is a very significant question, I think, because, and Avery Dulles has a whole book on models of revelation, and I think, I am not always in agreement with Avery Dulles, but on this one, I think he's on to something. Where he, I think it's in chapter 9 of that book, he abandons model thinking for once in his life and says, now I'm going to take a position here. And I think that revelation is some kind of symbolic communication on God's part. So it's not a direct statement of propositions by God. It's the symbolic leading of the people through elemental meaning, in Lonergan's expression, to the awareness of the fact that there is a God that loves us, wants us to be with, wants to be with us, wants midline between God's self and us. And then out of that, and out of reflection on that, the church arrives at certain doctrinal propositions, none of which is a self-evident truth, but many of which are truth. And a true proposition will always be true.
Okay. Now, are those the best opinions of the day? He uses the phrase...
scientific judgments are the best opinions of the day. In theology, what Lonergan, okay. Dogma for Lonergan has a very restrictive meaning, and he claims this is the meaning of the term dogma in the First Vatican Council. The word dogma in the text of the First Vatican Council refers to propositions that we could not know had there not been a divine revelation that enabled us to arrive at the truth of these propositions. Dogma, doctrine can be used to mean a lot more than that. But dogma is a very restrictive meaning in the language of the First Vatican Council, and that's the way Lonergan, he doesn't quite say it in method because he probably would have gotten in trouble if he had, but I think what he means to say is let's leave it that restrictive so that what can genuinely be qualify as dogma are statements held to be true that we could not know at all had there not been a divine revelation. So that the Word of God became incarnate, that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and so on. Those things that we could not know otherwise, outside of this historically contingent entrance of God into history, only that qualifies as dogma, and dogma has a permanent validity. This is Lonergan's hold on it. But how do you adjudicate or justify the permanent validity? You have to. He has made the judgment that the church was being authentic when it arrived at these judgments. Okay. And so that's part of it. That, you know, that there was an authenticity involved in the process that led to this. And in fact, with Nicaea, that there was the beginning of intellectual conversion there. Because what does consubstantial mean? It means that the same things are said of the Father as are said of the Son, except their names. But everything else is the same. The Father's, what's different is the Father's the Father and the Son is Son. But every other predication is the same. It's to be said of them. That's what the word consubstantial means. Okay, so that's dogma for Lonergan, and you do not, for him, you don't go back on that. But he doesn't go back on it because he's made the judgment that this was the church in its authenticity arriving at these particular statements. But he will hold that a lot of other statements, and obviously we have a record of them, you know, Walter Pritchard's the document that he put out several years before his death, of like 20 different propositions that the church held at one point, which the church no longer holds. So there are many things, and limbo is the latest one to go, you know, just within the last 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
What happened to the limbo?
We no longer have to believe in it, if in fact you ever did.
I just wanted to get, Bob, I was asking you about this last week, and so in meaning mediated by immediacy, we talk about, or Lonergan talks about that in terms of a mystical experience of God.
Oh, okay, let's get the expression here, though.
Is that right?
It's not meaning mediated by immediacy. It's mediated immediacy, or a mediated return to immediacy. That's the expression that you were...
Right.
There's the passage that beyond, aside from the world mediated by meaning...
Right.
There is the mediated return to immediacy in the mating of lovers and in the prayerful mystic's cloud of unknowing. That's his sentence for method and theology. So it's back to immediacy, but mediated through the whole mutual self-mediation. Let's take lovers.
Right.
The mutual self-mediation that has gone on as their relationship has developed, which finally has led them to this... sexual union, which is a return to immediacy, but it's mediated by the whole mutual self-mediation of their relationship. So it's a mediated return to immediacy. Or in our when we finally reach, however sporadically, a state of union with God, you know, the kind of thing that Teresa and John of the Cross are telling us is at the end of this journey. Well, that's a return to immediacy, but it's mediated through all the struggles
and the ins and outs of that it took us to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Or a real letting go in meditation, centering prayer. Just, you know, is a mediated Buddhist meditation, is a mediated return to immediacy, and just let everything go. Just, but it's not the infant's world of immediacy.
Right.
It's our return to immediacy from a world mediated by meaning. We're letting all that scaffolding go for a while, and we just are. You know?
And that's not elemental meaning, though, right? That would be reflected meaning.
What would be the state itself?
Mm-hmm.
The Buddhists will tell you just let everything go. If a thought comes, let it go. So and what they're appealing to you to do is to let all mediation go for a while. All mediation. And all concern about meaning, and just be. And be collected. So I think, but the expression is mediated return to immediacy.
Okay.
Is the expression that he uses in anything else? This one? Because I want to get into the next one, secularization. So my summary here is I have really labored over this paper, and I still don't think I've got. I don't know whether he's making a firm position or not, or taking a firm position. I think he's basically saying that what is sacral in one time might become secular in another time. And what we need to do is to find a way of adjudicating the authenticity of that sort of movement. I think that's what he's saying. But anyway, I'm going to take my summary from the paper that I wrote for the Lonergan Workshop last summer, and also for the Colloquium on Violence and Religion in Koblenz, Germany. I gave the paper in Germany as well last summer. The entire paper was on sacralization and desacralization in Lonergan and Girard. And if you want that paper, you can go to the COVNR. Just go to Google and type in COVNR, and it's not case sensitive. And it'll call up the papers that were given last summer. Or if you really want it, I'll send it to you as an attachment. But what I'm summarizing here, what I said about Lonergan's paper, sacralization and secularization. I think the most important contribution of this paper is, I think, whether he intended it or not, he's giving us one set of heuristic notions. There's a sacralization to be dropped. There is a sacralization to be fostered. There is a secularization to be welcomed. And there's a secularization to be resisted. And what he's trying to do is to offer some hints as to how we might determine what are the sacralizations to be dropped? What are the sacralizations to be fostered? What are the secularizations to be welcomed? What are the secularizations to be resisted? The words secular, secularize, secularization, secularist, and the words sacral, sacralize, sacralization, desacralize, desacralization. He says all of those are neutral terms. They don't have a value connotation to them as he's using them. They're purely descriptive. They describe attitudes of persons and communities. So a role, a place, a time, an object is sacral when the activity involved is regarded as religious by the participants. And it's secular when the activity involved is not regarded as religious. Similarly, desacralize and desacralization denote a withdrawal of sacrality from what previously had been regarded as religious. And an example out of the scriptures, meat sacralized by pagans was desacralized by Christians. It was regarded as sacred by pagans and offered to the gods. The Christians said that's pure myth. They desacralized it. They made it just meat. Okay, so then the issue is how the transition from sacral, an attitude, to really sacred, a judgment.
from secular as an attitude towards things to this is really not religious. Or in the case of desacralization, from sacral to secular and then to profane. That is, from what participants regard as such and such to what really is so. How do we make that judgment? This is a big issue before the church today. I think it was prominent in the papal election. This fear of secularism, right? But a question at the same time as to whether this heuristic was really in effect, okay? Or whether the fear of secularism could be also a return to another sacralizing of some domains that perhaps should be allowed to be secular. These are the questions that he's dealing with here. And I'm not taking it. I don't mean that as a stance, but it is a very serious question on my part. So it's by meeting this question of how do we make the transition from the attitude to the truth that we can determine which sacralizations are to be dropped and which to be fostered, and which secularizations are to be welcomed and which are to be resisted. So for Lonergan, there are three criteria for these transitions. So he's giving us some help with this. But I still am struggling to get my mind around the whole paper, but there's some help that he's given. One criterion is personal, one is communal, one is historical. The personal criterion, and again, we have nothing else to rely on for him, ultimately, except this, is the authenticity of the subject. The communal criterion is the authenticity of the subject's tradition, and the historical criterion arises in as much as religion and culture develop, so that sacral domains can be desacralized over the course of time, while what seems to be secular activity can be given a genuine religious significance. So I think we find Jesus doing both of those things. I think we find him desacralizing the Sabbath and saying the Sabbath was made for human beings, not human beings for the Sabbath. But we also find him sacralizing what might be regarded as secular, the story of the Good Samaritan, taking care of someone who had been treated violently, and you run into this person on the street and you bathe his wounds and take him to... That's a pretty normal thing to do. It's not regarded as a sacral thing. And yet he says, as often as you do that to one of these, you do it to me. And so he's saying this is... He's giving it a genuine religious significance. So he's overturning a lot of notions of sacrality, the sacred and the profane, in some of his statements to the religious authorities of his day and in some of the parables that he tells. Okay, so Lonergan sets the issue in the context of Paul Ricoeur's work on Freud, which Lonergan found... I know he had an incredible respect for that particular book, because he found that what Ricoeur was doing was taking Freud with eminent seriousness, and then using Freud, not in a manipulative sense, to purify religion of its inauthenticities, while enabling that purified religion to still remain immune to Freud's universal critique of religion. So he's advancing the positions. What Ricoeur is doing is what Lonergan would call advancing the positions in Freud and reversing the counterpositions. But the first thing he's doing, and what Lonergan would say is that what you do with anyone, is advance the positions. And what Ricoeur did was to find the truth in Freud and push it as far as he could. So he finds that Ricoeur distinguishes religious... He uses Freud to distinguish religious maturity and religious retardation. And so Lonergan will draw on Ricoeur to encourage us to avoid mistaking retardation for development and mistaking development for retardation. And how do we, what do we do? Ultimately, the appeal has to be to the inner conviction of authenticity generated by the self-transcendence that is promoted and sustained by the gift of divine love. All right, so that's one context, the one that, and the example that is given by Ricoeur. The next context was a debate that was current at the time concerning the relationship between the religious life, the inner life of prayer, and the secular, desacralized world in which we live. And you could take this and apply it to the two strands at the papal conclave, I think, because I think these strands are still in existence. But for Lonergan, at his time, the debate was exemplified in Marie-Dominique Chenu, the Dominican theologian, and Jean Danielou, the Jesuit. And in this case, Lonergan is evincing more sympathy for the Dominican than he is for the Jesuit, because the Dominican is being more Thomist in his acknowledgement of the intelligibility and goodness of this world, and which is a very Thomist theme, of course. So, but it's the same theme that was played out in the Middle Ages in the Augustinian Aristotelian debates. As a Thomist, Chenu will gladly support the progress of natural and profane forces all through history, confident that this progress will only assist genuine transcendence. He's not afraid of it. Now, Lonergan expresses a qualified agreement with that, as would be obvious from reading Insight. But his proviso is important. There are many ways in which progress is corrupted by bias and turned into decline. And so we always have to look to the redemptive role of religion in overcoming bias and restoring progress, authentic religion. Danielou, there's a problem with Danielou because he wants some kind of restoration of Christendom. And Lonergan would not be sympathetic to that, but he expresses the qualified agreement with Danielou on the need that people have for symbols and the need of for almost all people of a certain amount of symbolic thinking if they're going to be educated into the genuine sacred. But Lonergan's proviso here is that there's also a false sacred, and that false sacred can be promoted through an uncritical symbolic mentality. And much secularization is long overdue in our world. For example, Danielou speaks of providing cultural and social foundations through religious symbols for the faith of the poor. But Lonergan says if you want to help the poor, the first thing to do is to spend a lot of time doing hard economic analysis, because that's where they need their help. And in that context, then, preach the gospel. But otherwise, you might be preaching ideology. Now, it seems from section 5, A Genealogy of Differences, and from section 6, the conclusion of the 1973 lecture, that he's expecting that there will be development in this through history, in this relationship between what is sacred and what is secular. He expects there will be development, and that rear guard reaction against legitimate secularization will result in an outraged and outright rejection of all religion as the futile champion of a dead and unlamented past. I think this is a danger today as well. Secularization is the liberation of a secular domain from the once but no longer appropriate extension of the sacral. For instance, in the time of the decline of the Roman Empire and the beginnings of the Darker Ages, the church had a lot of power over civic affairs. As he says, well, it might have had some legitimacy under those circumstances, but that kind of secular power on the part of a sacral authority is inappropriate for our time. So for it to be known as secularization, there also must be known that the extension of religious feeling over that domain is no longer appropriate. Without that knowledge, a legitimate and overdue secularization will appear to some people to be an incomprehensible desacralization. They're taking away our foundations. They're robbing us of this. So, for example, the long and slow decay of the empire, he's referring to the Roman Empire, created a vacuum of talent and prestige that gradually transferred to local bishops, as they had some education, an increasing share in the burden of secular offices. Again, the beginnings of Western civilization in the dark and medieval periods found in the church traditions and structures that cradled and later reinforced feudal economies and politics. But what is justified by the decline of a civilization, or by the weak initial stages of its successor, is bound to experience an ever-diminishing role as its successor or successors become capable of handling their own affairs. So there's been a series of secularizations in the body politic, reinforced by secularization in science, in philosophy, in literature, in education. All of this is legitimate. If you regard, for instance, that each of the sciences has its own method, and that method shouldn't be dictated by theology. Continued sacralization can be the extension of the mantle of religion over the quite traditional opinions of ignorant people. But at the other extreme, secularization becomes secularism. The secularizer denies literal meaning to the secularizer, so secularization denies literal meaning to the symbol, but doesn't deny the symbol all objective significance. The symbol can have a symbolic meaning. But for the secularist, the only meaning of the symbol is purely subjective, as for Freud. Okay? It expresses in some inadequate fashion the feelings of religious people, but says nothing about what really is so. For the secularist, the hermeneutics and the metaphysics that find a real meaning for the symbol are as childish as the symbols themselves. That secularism can be overcome by a sophisticated kind of re-sacralization, which is what Ricoeur is doing by purifying religion through applying Freudian criticism to it. Acknowledge the insight of the critic of religion, pin it down exactly, discover the oversight that made him a critic of religion, use the insight for the purification of religion, use the oversight for a renewal of its vitality and power. Okay, so that's what Lonergan is saying. Now, in my paper, I went on to take a stab at what today would constitute a sacralization to be, what's his precise terminology? Sacralization to be dropped, sacralization to be fostered, and so on. Sacralization to be dropped would be any use of the name of God to effect power over the decisions of human communities, to justify exclusion, marginalization, persecution, violence. All of those are sacralizations to be dropped. Sacralizations to be fostered would be any manifestations in any cultural and religious traditions of what we Christians call the law of the cross. Self-sacrificing love for the sake of the other, the mystery of the suffering servant, wherever that is found in history. And its redemptive quality when it is loving self-surrender. Secularizations to be welcomed, anything that follows from being attentive, intelligent, reasonable, responsible. In the world of science, common sense, history, politics, these are all secularizations to be welcomed. Secularizations to be resisted are any attempts to take our fate completely into our own hands and to claim that we are the masters or mistresses of our own fate to the point where we're denying the fact that we are creatures of God. So something along those lines is what I was trying to point out. But this is where we are today in terms of where there are these terms, where there are legitimate sacralizations and legitimate secularizations. So that's my treatment of that. Anything do we want to discuss? I can touch on the main themes of the scope of renewal very quickly. So we have about 10 minutes. Anything that we want to discuss about this? Yes, Jeff?
I do. Let me. This is from 279, but let me just paraphrase, because I'm. If you want to look at the original, 279.
Okay.
The first complete paragraph.
Okay.
But even Hebrew achievement was incomplete. It did direct worship to the true God and to him alone, but its apprehension of the true God was shot through with anthropomorphism. So it was centuries later, and then just skip down, the Christian fathers and still later the scholastic theologians borrowed from the Greeks conceptual and verbal tools for purifying their apprehension of God. Now, the reason I point this out with emphasis on that word purifying as a move away from anthropomorphic accounts of God is to ask you how intellectual conversion factors here and how Lonergan would assess the Hebrew situation with his words, sacral, secular, and so on, with all his terminology. So,
That's a good question. I think what he's saying, first of all, is that there is a legitimate secularization that takes place in the Hebrew prophets, in the sense that, again, I'm going to appeal to my reading of Eric Voegelin's understanding of the Old Testament. But for Voegelin, the cosmos itself is no longer sacred. What is sacred is the intervention of God in the history of these people. And this is constitutive of the revelation of God to Israel. So it's desacralizing the cosmos and sacralizing the presence of God in this community. So the powers, the cosmic powers, are robbed of their sacred authority. Fatalism, superstition, and all of that goes with it. So that's the secularization. And particularly as the prophets go to work on the remnants of that purely cosmological mentality in the people themselves, with the Baals and the sacrifices of animals. Animal sacrifices are condemned by the prophets. That isn't sacred. Our God is not interested in the carcasses of bulls and goats. That's a false sacred. What Girard would call a deviated transcendence. So there is that legitimate secularization in the prophetic literature. What is incomplete is the anthropomorphism that will have God seated on a throne, or possibly the projection of human emotion into the divinity. There's the purging of the purification of the notion of God. There's still a notion that it took the prophets themselves a while to get beyond of God as being vindictive or jealous in a ressentiment sense or whatever. So, now the Christian fathers and still later the scholastic theologians borrowed from the Greeks conceptual and verbal tools for purifying the apprehension of God would probably be the kinds of things that I would think that he's probably thinking here of God as the actus totius entus in Aquinas, the pure act, without potency, without limit, infinite, and all of that. All of these categories that were taken over themselves by purifying Greek philosophy, as Aquinas had it better than Aristotle did, but using those to purify the apprehension of God. The Trinity, thinking of the Trinity and to think of it in a way that is not mythic took a long time. Tertullian still thought that God had to be a body because he couldn't conceive of anything real that wasn't a body. So the purification of that in the early church of that kind of, and that's definitely the need for an intellectual conversion, as Laudergan points out in the Way to Nicaea. A lot of the patristic literature is wrestling with the issues of religious, of intellectual conversion. And Tertullian was you know, he wasn't a heretic or anything, but he could, he had, there had, God was some kind of funny stuff. But it had, God had to be stuff, because to be real, you have to be stuff, you know, of some kind.
Same for Augustine as well, yeah, as a man that came.
It took Augustine a long time to get to the point that real meant true. Didn't mean a body, but true. Well, we don't have time for the scope of renewal, but maybe we'll touch on it at the beginning of the next class. Is that okay? So what we're doing next week is we're switching to a third collection, and it's the first three papers in there. Dialectic of Authority. It's in the notes that I gave you at the first lecture. Dialectic of Authority. Well, you want the page numbers, it's 5 to 53 in the third collection. Three papers, Dialectic of Authority, Method, Trends, and Variations, and Aquinas Today, Tradition and Innovation. The shortest of those is Dialectic of Authority, but it may turn out to be one that will generate as much conversation as others, I don't know. Although it may be one that we're kind of used to now today, too. Authority is legitimate power, legitimacy is conferred by authenticity, the community acknowledges the authenticity, and that's where the authority comes from. Otherwise, it's just power. That notion is quite interesting.
Bob, would you mind emailing me your attachment of
of that